It's life and safety for those people who live out there and the road travelers. Yeah, it's just a huge benefit.
A stimulus grant for broadband and cell service in McCarthy. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 14th of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage police respond to a string of deaths in the city.
They were cleaning their pistols, and one friend accidentally shot himself and his other friend into the abdomen.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
State troopers believe there may be a person missing along the flood-damaged Taylor Highway. Spokeswoman Megan Peters says officers checked a vehicle found in a flooded creek bed on the road and found no occupants. Troopers believe the driver of the vehicle may be Charles Collins, age 56, of Eagle River. He is unaccounted for and considered missing. Peters says troopers flew into the area where 18 vehicles and 20 to 30 people are cut off by washouts and mudslides north of Chicken. She says most have decided to stay put and wait for road repairs.
Troopers went in and we landed and we talked to some people. We gave them the option. If you want to leave, now's the time to do it. We will take you to Toke, but you have to be still responsible for yourselves and your vehicles. Most people, they figured they could just wait it out. They had motorhomes there, and they thought it was actually kind of neat.
Heavy weekend rain swelled rivers and streams in the 40-mile region, severely damaging sections of the Taylor Highway, about 100 miles between Chicken and Eagle. The State Department of Transportation is working to get a rough one-lane road open soon so stranded motorists can get out. It may be next week before the road is reopened to general public traffic. The tiny village of McCarthy is soon to be getting big upgrades in their internet capability. More than $5 million in stimulus funds is headed to Alaska to provide wireless broadband connectivity and cell service to the remote Wrangell Mountain town and surrounding communities. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Copper Valley Telephone Cooperative has been providing telecommunications to the Copper Basin and some Prince William Sound communities since the 1960s. 2 years ago, CVT extended its fiber optic cable as far as Chitna on the edge of the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and Preserve. Earlier this month, CVT was awarded $5.2 million in stimulus funds money for communications improvements along the McCarthy Road and in the town of McCarthy itself. Jim Gifford is CVT's chief operating officer.
Well, the plan is to extend microwave connectivity, which will provide high-speed internet, enhanced phone and data services from the end of the fiber optic cable located in Chitna out to the McCarthy area. And it includes some new sites along the McCarthy Road, which will provide cellular and wireless broadband coverage all along the McCarthy Road and out into the McCarthy-Kennecott area.
Although only a few people live in McCarthy year-round, the town is located in Wrangell-St. Elias and is increasingly popular with summer visitors. About 60 miles of rough road separates Chitna from McCarthy. Gifford says the upgrade will provide benefits to around 20 local businesses now and in the future.
The system we'll be putting in will support not only today's technology, but future technologies. So even higher speed access to the internet, the things that we can't think of today, but somebody will, and we'll have a service offering. The platform and the systems that we are installing will support all those future new services.
Gifford says the Copper Valley Wireless arm of CVT was successful in securing a grant for rural utility services under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which is providing more than $7 billion for broadband projects nationwide. CVT expects to begin construction work on the project next year, although a series of environmental studies must be completed before that can happen. McCarthy attracts thousands of visitors a year. Many fly in, but others travel the 63 miles of grueling gravel road up from Chitna.
The people who actually visit the area, I understand, are in the tens of thousands. So it's certainly quite a larger impact. It provides for distance learning for those who do homeschooling. It's life and safety for those people who live out there.
Gifford says McCarthy was provided CVT services in the 1990s by satellite, which presented a constant challenge to the telephone cooperative. Gifford says a lot of environmental review has to be done to satisfy FCC and rural utility service requirements before the new project can move forward. That work is expected to take months. Then bid packages will be sent out this winter. Construction is expected to start next spring. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
American Indian and Alaska Native women still experience the highest rates of violence of any group in the nation, according to a report that came out yesterday. The report covers a project launched in 2002 by the Family Violence Prevention Fund. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Anamar Javi is co-author of Building Domestic Violence Healthcare Responses, a Promising Practices report. She says domestic violence and sexual assault are linked to many diseases, including arthritis, sexually transmitted infections, ulcers, and even diabetes.
Our goal was both to improve health outcomes for women facing abuse or who may have faced abuse previously. We know that domestic violence can impact your health status many years down the line, even when you're out of that relationship.
Healthcare providers began asking patients about violence in their lives. The percentage of American Indian and Alaska Native women getting screened went from 4% to 48%. Mar Javi says victims who wouldn't go to the police, therapists, or shelters are more open to talking with their healthcare providers.
Our goal is that any woman who goes to their doctor or nurse knows that they can talk to them if domestic violence or sexual assault is ever an issue, or they can go directly to the programs that are available in their community.
In Maine, near the Canadian border, Jane Root is director of the Maliseet Indian Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Program. She experienced the program's effectiveness firsthand. A woman's relative suspected domestic violence was occurring and encouraged the victim to seek help. Nothing changed until a nurse asked her about domestic violence, and the victim did share information about her situation. Root says a counselor then talked with the victim about some steps she could take.
She did, in fact, move forward, file charges against him, left the abusive relationship, got into our transitional housing program, and, you know, went on with her life in a safe way.
More than 100 organizations are taking part in the project, including facilities in Ketchikan, Prince William Sound, Fairbanks, and the Eastern Aleutians. I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, communities in Southeast Alaska hire more village public safety officers.
Just being in the communities changes the community itself, knowing that there's someone there to respond in the time of any need.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Institute of Technology Maritime Department is offering a Coast Guard-approved Marine Oiler class beginning September 13th in Seward. The course will familiarize students with propulsion, power generation, and auxiliary systems on motor and steam ships. Required prerequisite training criteria is on the web at avtec.edu. Information at 800-478-5389. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
State lawmakers today began work to come up with new legislation and a redirection of state money to deal with the state's current fight against methamphetamine. The action follows up on laws passed in 2006 that focused on the home-based manufacture of the drug. Deputy Attorney General Rick Svobodny heads the Department of Law's Criminal Division. He reported that the new law has worked by restricting access to the basic ingredients of meth, primarily pseudoephedrine, available as cold and sinus medicine. He said the number of meth labs has decreased from 37 in 2005 to 9 last year. However, he told the House Judiciary Committee that the illegal sale and use of meth has increased since the law was enacted. He says that indicates it is being imported and that the consumption is spreading throughout the state. MATSU Republican Carl Gatto said those results come as no surprise to anyone who was involved in working on the 2006 bill. Lawmakers at the time had no illusions that they would diminish use of the drug.
We were after the taking care of the issue of contaminated sites, fires, abuse of children, abuse of spouses, and said, if we can get that, we'll take it, even if we can't get the reduction in the consumption. And maybe that's why we're here, is to see if there's anything, any avenue we can pursue that would reduce consumption.
Public Safety Commissioner Audie Holloway said the imported meth now being sold on the streets originates in Mexico, and it's more concentrated than the homemade meth of 5 years ago.
The lines of geography have changed a little bit when it comes to drugs and Alaska. We basically share a border with Mexico because we get drugs from through all kinds of modes of transportation brought in that originate in some fashion or another in Mexico or by the control of Mexican drug trafficking organizations. And we can't say that we're too far away to be affected, because we certainly are.
Svobodny said the criminal justice system is not able to deal with addiction. It becomes a health problem for society to deal with. The committee hopes to prepare its recommendations in time for the governor to include them in next year's budget and legislative agenda. In less than 12 hours, Anchorage police responded to 4 incidents resulting in fatalities. KSKA's Len Anderson has details on this string of deaths that began late Tuesday afternoon and ended early Wednesday morning.
The causes of death include a shooting, an apparent medical condition, a vehicle accident, and a stabbing. Anchorage police spokeswoman Anita Schell began with the unintentional shooting of 26-year-old Elliot Taylor of Anchorage.
A couple of friends that had gone out shooting, and they came to one of the friends' homes on Aphrodite Drive, where they were cleaning their pistols, and one friend accidentally shot himself and his other friend, which is Elliot Taylor, into the abdomen. Elliot survived until about 1:30 in the morning, until he succumbed to his injuries at a local hospital.
Schell said police have not yet released the name of the shooter, pending the conclusion of their investigation. She noted the two men were lifelong friends, and Taylor was a 3-year veteran of the Anchorage Fire Department. Not long after that call, Anchorage police responded to a 7 p.m. single vehicle accident on the Seward Highway, just south of the Dowling Road overpass.
The witnesses say that a Ford SUV had rolled over multiple times after leaving the northbound lane and passing through the median ditch. It also crossed 2 lanes of oncoming traffic before coming to rest on its wheels on the east or outside of the metal guardrail. The driver was 25-year-old Jonathan McDonald, who was thrown from the vehicle and died from head injuries at the scene.
McDonald's sole passenger, his brother, was not severely injured but taken to a local hospital. Anchorage's third fatality response took place just before midnight at a residence on the 300 block of Ellen Circle.
19-year-old was having difficulty breathing. They tried CPR, family members tried CPR on the male, but he died at the scene. And so an autopsy is going to be performed today to determine the manner and the cause of death in that situation.
Police later identified the 19-year-old as Lauren Siebert. The fourth death was a call the police received after midnight early Wednesday morning.
We responded to a stabbing of a young lady, 22-year-old Brittany Gillum, who was found in a municipal parkland between 36th and Tudor. And she had a stab wound to her torso, resulting in her death, and that is being investigated as a homicide.
The police would appreciate any information about Brittany Gillum that might assist in the investigation into her death. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The Tlingit and Haida Central Council is expanding its Village Public Safety Officer program. TNH recently added 4 VPSO positions, 2 in Cake, 1 in Heidelberg, and 1 in Pelican. That's in addition to officers already in Angoon and Thorn Bay. Program coordinator Jason Wilson says the Central Council is looking to fill positions in Gustavus, Kassan, and Saxman.
VPSOs are first responders, so what that means basically is we're looking at search and rescue, response to fire, law enforcement.
The Parnell administration and state legislators this year appropriated more than $11 million for BPSO programs statewide. That's an increase of more than $1.5 million from last year. While funding and program oversight comes from the Department of Public Safety, BPSOs are employed by local native organizations. Tlingit and Haida received nearly $680,000 in this year's operating budget to manage the program in Southeast, up about $211,000 from last year. Wilson says having a VPSO can make a huge difference to a community.
Just being in the communities changes the community itself, knowing that there's someone there to respond in the time of any need. There was a fire recently up in Cake. A house did burn down, and the VPSO was the first on the scene. I believe there were 2 or 3 kids in the home, and I'm not saying that the VPSO saved these kids' lives, but they ensured the safety of these children and also made sure that the fire didn't spread to the rest of the houses that are close by.
Wilson says the Central Council and state troopers work closely with local tribal councils and governments to find a good VPSO for each community. VPSOs don't carry guns, but do investigate crimes and can make arrests. There are currently 71 VPSOs serving small communities in Alaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by North Rim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. North Rim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The missile defense system at Fort Greely is on track to be completed by 2012. That was the word from Assistant Missile Defense Agency Director Colonel George Bond during a presentation for the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce yesterday. Bond says the last of 3 missile fields is being constructed.
In early 2012, we'll complete the final missile field. We'll have 34 silos available, and we'll have fielded 26 interceptors.
Bond says Missile Field 1 will go out of service.
Missile Field 1 was part of the original test bed, so it was built fairly quickly. When I say test bed, it wasn't that we were going to test fire missiles out of Fort Greely, but the whole concept of ground-based mid-course defense was new. And so this is a first-of-its-kind system. So there's been a very steep learning curve since Missile Field 1 in the construction of Missile Fields 2 and 3. So there are a lot of advantages to putting missiles in Missile Field 2 and 3, and we'll shut down the original 6-silo test bed.
Missile defense system development in Alaska is not restricted to Fort Greely at Delta Junction. Bond says Clear Air Force Station in Anderson, which currently provides early warning for intercontinental and sea-launched ballistic missiles, will receive a major upgrade to more directly support Fort Greely missile defense.
Clear Air Station has been the home to an early warning radar for over 50 years. The current radar is approximately 10 years old and still serves an early warning mission. We're simply going to upgrade this radar so it also can track ballistic missiles, and it will be brought into the architecture of ballistic missile defense for defense of the United States.
Bond says the plan for the upgrade is not complete yet, but the project will likely take place between 2011 and 2015 and cost $200 million. He says while CLEAR's mission will increase, there are no plans to bump up staffing at the Anderson Base Station. The $35 billion mid-course missile defense system also includes 4 interceptors at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, which additionally serves as the system's testing facility. Interceptor test results have been spotty. During the latest trial held in February, an interceptor launched from Vandenberg failed to hit a dummy target missile launched from a South Pacific island. The contract for development of the system, currently held by Boeing, is up for rebid this fall. Fishing for king salmon is closed on two rivers on the Kuskokwim due to low numbers of the fish. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes has more.
King salmon numbers are low in the Tulooksack and Queefluk rivers this year, but that's not something new.
It's already been a number of years on both of these systems of not meeting escapement.
Sean Sanchez is the deputy manager of the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service runs the weir projects on both rivers along with the local tribes. Those projects count fish heading upriver to spawn. Each river has an escapement goal of how many fish they need to get past the weir in order to keep the fishery sustainable for future runs. And Sanchez says they haven't been meeting their goals for a while.
On the Queefluk, we have not met that number of fish the last 2 years, and on the Tulooksack, we have not met it the last 3 years. And the numbers, the data that's coming in right now based on the current escapement on the Queefluk River and the Tulooksack, we're heading down the path of not meeting it again.
In response to the low numbers, the Federal Office of Fish and Wildlife, along with the State Department of Fish and Game, has announced an emergency closure for Chinook or king salmon on both the Tulooksack and Queefluk Rivers. The closure prohibits rod and reel fishing for kings and prohibits fishing for kings through set nets. Fishing for other salmon like sockeye and chum is still allowed. Sanchez says they will be monitoring this by restricting the gear used to target kings. Set nets are allowed, but they have to be small mesh size.
Set nets of 4-inch mesh or smaller are still allowed so that people can still have opportunity to catch things like whitefish or pike or chum or sockeye. The likelihood of catching Chinook in the 4-inch is much less than in a much larger mesh.
As for rod and reel fishing, Sanchez says it comes down to the gear.
You know, even if they're using the smaller gear, but they're sitting and throwing right at a bunch of Chinook right on a spawn bed, well, then you know that's what we're trying to minimize is just the Chinook take. So a lot of it's going to be the actions that people take, and particularly or specifically targeting Chinook that we're trying to restrict.
The Queefluk tribe supports the closure. The tribe created a resolution requesting a similar closure. No one at the Tulooksack Tribal Office could comment. The closure runs until the end of July, which is considered the end of the run. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
For the past dozen years, fisheries management experts have held that boats go after the biggest fish first. Now, biologists at the University of Washington are challenging the idea that people fish down the food web. They say fishing is a business and that fishermen go for whatever is most profitable, whether it be crab or cod. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
University of Washington biologists have challenged the idea that people fish down the food web. A decade ago, a study suggested that fishermen go for predators first. When the fisheries at the top are depleted, fishermen would move on to smaller and smaller fish. Daniel Pauly, a biologist at the University of British Columbia who conducted the fishing down study, describes the model.
Instead of catching cod, for example, in Newfoundland and in Atlantic Canada, we fish snow crab and shrimp, which were the prey of the cod when they were there.
But Suresh Sethi, who led the University of Washington study and who has worked as a commercial fisherman in Bristol Bay, says that people are looking for profits, not predators. Since fishing is fundamentally a business, boats go after what will bring them the most money, which isn't always the biggest fish.
What we find is that species lower in food webs, like shellfish, case of Alaska, everyone can think of how valuable king crab is. Things at the bottom of food webs tend to be actually higher priced as a group than things at the top of food webs.
This means that fishermen develop the most high-value and abundant fisheries first, not necessarily the ocean's top predators. The study examined global catch and economic data from the past 55 years, and it's a first study of its kind. The University of Washington biologists say their research should help those managing fisheries anticipate where the economic pressures will be and which fisheries will be developed next. Here's Trevor Branch, a co-author of the study.
One impact is that if you were a manager and you wanted to know which fisheries are going to develop next, where should you be looking for fishing impacts to hit? Well, the answer is start with the ones that have the most numbers. Start with the ones that have the highest prices. Start with the ones that are the lowest cost to develop, so the ones that are easy to access. And those are the ones that you should worry about being developed and targeted next.
As for Pauly, who conducted the fishing down research, he doesn't think that the University of Washington study refutes his data.
I say big deal, because this is completely neutral vis-a-vis what we wrote. Because it's not a refutation, it's not a confirmation. We never wrote about value.
But if there's one thing that all these biologists can agree upon, it's that fishing stocks aren't getting any bigger. Pauly's fishing down model predicts a sort of doomsday scenario for poorly managed fisheries. He warns that if the fishing industry is poorly managed, fishermen will keep going down the food chain until humans are left with only a diet of jellyfish and plankton stew. He says that happened to Namibia in Africa and could happen in other places with poor management practices. The University of Washington research is not as grim, but Sethi does say that fishing is a mature industry that's near its capacity.
Commercial fishing is now a mature industry, no longer a frontier setting. And so we don't expect additional protein to be generated from wild capture fisheries. There's just not left in the ocean to be developed. So what that says is that commercial fishing, yes, we expect what catch we do have now globally. We don't see any reason to see why that would fall off, and at least in the near future or midterm future. But if we want to keep getting more seafood protein into markets, it's going to have to come from aquaculture. We're going to have to farm it.
The University of Washington study was recently published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The National Park Service says it might seek reimbursement from a solo climber evacuated from Denali last week. The Park Service called on military helicopters to take 25-year-old Andrew Randolph off the mountain after camp doctors determined his behavior was erratic. The removal operation cost tens of thousands of dollars. Park Service is investigating whether criminal charges or the climber's insurance can help cover the cost. John Leonard, a Denali National Park and Preserve Ranger, says Mount McKinley sees only about a dozen solo climbers per year. Those climbers encounter higher rates of trouble than those who are part of a group. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer, Jocelyn Estes and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.